When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids, and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I asked my guest in this podcast and on stage here today. And the guest I'm asking today is a comedian, performer, and presenter. You're a fan of Radio 4, and why shouldn't you be? You will know him from his long-running collaboration with Brian Cox in the series The Infinite Monkey Cage. Please welcome Robin Ince. So, well, we settle down with our microphones.
I'm so glad that you mentioned he presents with Brian Cox. Yes. If they don't, people go, I can't believe it, we're going to see Brian Cox.
Yeah.
Oh, that's much older. Yeah.
Well, look, I think a lot of people would know the program I'm talking and all about you, but some people won't. There's a lot of things. So when we say Brian Cox, there are, of course, two Brian Coxes in the world who are terrifically famous. So you've plumped for the scientist, the physicist.
For the time being.
Rather than Succession and all that. So, but he must get fed up with that. Both of them must get fed up with that.
Well, yes, because in England, if you say you work with Brian Cox and then you say it's Professor Brian Cox, they're very excited, whereas in Scotland, they're very disappointed. So that's just kind of the way it works.
Yeah. All right. I hope you're not disappointed. It doesn't really matter because neither Brian Cox is here.
No, they're not going to be here.
There's only one Robbie Ince, yeah. And we've got you. So that's good. So you're here doing a show or shows. Yeah. How many shows are you doing?
I'm doing two shows today. I do a show at 1 o'clock at the Museum of Scotland called Weapons of Empathy, which is about books and all of the kind of adventures you can have within them.
Yes.
And then the other show is called Melons.
But Melon, you've chosen Melons.
Could
have been any fruit, I suppose.
It's basically a love letter to stand-up comedy. It's about the fact that when I was about 12, 13 years old, I first started really watching stand-up and watching Rick Mail and Alexi Sell, and I absolutely adored what I saw.
Yes.
And then I used to listen to you as well on the on Radio 4 on Whose line is it anyway?
Cabaret Upstairs.
And all
I introduced a lot of big acts.
Yeah,
there,
and I absolutely, you know, and I was in love with it. And then I had that normal thing, which is after a while you forget why you loved something, and you become a bit jaded. And it's about how I then kind of returned to my excitement about it as well.
You sort of formally gave up stand up comedy
about 17 times. Yeah, it never works.
There's a moment in your career when it was like giving up alcohol or cigarettes. You're giving it up. And how long did that last for?
It lasted about a week because everyone knew that I'd given up. So they knew I was available to do benefit shows. Oh. So immediately I get calls saying, we know you're not doing anything. And we're doing a special benefit now for some dogs that have not been well. Yeah. Please come around and do that.
That's the worst of all worlds, isn't it? Because you're still doing it, but you're not getting paid for it.
But I have to do it. I mean, I love it. I think that's the thing is underneath it all, you have all these battles and you get worried. And of course, during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, you know, egos fracture and all that kind of thing. But it is to me the joy of creating things. And that's what. And I think the older I've got, the more I just really love making stuff.
Okay, good. And you've been at the Edinburgh Festival since, is it 1990?
The first year I came up just to watch, I was 18 years old. I got a summer job and then I had enough money to come up here. And I saw Jeremy Hardy, which was a lovely thing because I saw Jeremy, Harriet Watt, I think it was at. And after the show, he was selling his poster for £1 to go to Terence Higgins Trust.
All right.
And I still have that poster. I actually sometimes show it in the show and it just says, "To Robin, with love, Jeremy Hardy." All right. And I have that lovely thing of that bit where some of the people that I first knew from just loving their work. People like you, Clive. And then you
have to add that as an afterthought every time.
No. I will, though. I know how this business works. And I just, you know, and it's a beautiful thing when, you know, when you get to work with someone like Alexei Sayle or whoever it is, and you think, my God, I was 12 years old when I first saw you. And
exactly. Yeah. And then you end up, you know, doing things with them. It's great. All right. So that's just, I'm just sketching in your background there. But you've also done TV programs, the 11 o'clock show. Mm. Ricky Gervais, you've worked with as well.
Yeah, we don't talk anymore. And
good, I've stumbled on something.
Yeah, no.
Well, I was going to say he's probably quite a tough person to work with.
Well, I don't know if we fell out, but he just stopped talking to me because I kind of picked him up on some of the stuff that I felt was a little bit excessive in his act. And I don't think he's probably used to. I think when you get very, very rich, you're surrounded by people who will always say yes to you because they all want to take a piece of the money.
Right.
And so if you have an old friend who questions you, you go, hang on a minute, this doesn't happen in my life. Yeah. I'm never questioned. So that we did have that kind of, but I mean, we didn't, it was only quite recently that we come, but we knew each other for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it was just, and again, it's that bit where sometimes the older you get, the more you feel you do sometimes need to say out things aloud so you don't end up being complicit sometimes.
Yes. All right. I'm with you on that. I'm just noting I haven't made enough money that I've got everybody around me agreeing with the whole time. I can't find anybody to agree with me, certainly my personal life. I won't go into that. But you were courageous enough to say to him, well, I think that joke says something I don't think he's right.
Yeah, I just didn't. To be honest, the comedy that I really love is the comedy that if it punches at all, it punches up. And I think punching down at people and attacking people who are probably more likely to be attacked in the first place in their life anyway, just by leaving the front door. I think I love, you know, when you watch someone like John Hegley, you know, when you watch someone like Josie Long, you watch these people and the shows are full of love and joy and people come out elevated. Everyone comes out. And it's like I've never really particularly like picking on the front row, you know, when they go, oh, you married to her, she's going to leave you, you're ugly, you're fat, you've got a rubbish job. And then everyone leaves just going, I'm filled with existential anxiety. I need some stones to put in my pockets. I'm going to jump into a canal. That seems to me to be the antithesis of entertainment.
Did you hear that story about Tony Allen, who's an old-time comedian? He was sitting in the front row of a show in Edinburgh. There was an American comedian just coming along and saying, what do you do? What do you do? And he got to Tony Allen and he said, yeah, what do you do? And Tony Allen said, well, I'm a comedian. What about you?
Tony was one of the first comedians I ever saw live, the Comedy Store, when I was 16 years old. I saw Tony, Jeremy Hardy, Kit Hollaback.
Yes.
And Tony had a wonderful thing. You might not know Tony Allen. He pops up in The Young Ones. He's an anarchist as well, wrote a wonderful book about stand-up comedy. But unfortunately, he's very ill and he's dying. Actually had, though, a wake for him called the Woke Wake, so he could hear everyone talking about him while he was still alive, and Alexei and John Hegley and people like that went. And I think, isn't that a beautiful thing? Because you see sometimes when someone like, you know, Sinead O'Connor died, and you suddenly everyone's standing up for her.
Yeah.
And you think, well, we need to do that in life. We need to tell people that we love them now.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, very, very good point. Yeah. Yeah, Tony, I did a documentary once. So we'll get onto your wonders in a minute. But I did a documentary on the Comedy Store, and he was an alternative comedian before there were alternative comedians. So he came in to do an interview, and he said, oh, I've written a book, Clive. And I said, do you want a copy? And I said, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And I can't afford to give them away. So he made me buy it. And then naturally I flicked through to see a reference to me.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, and then Clive was, I never really liked his stuff. But so I bought an insult, a mild insult, but shameless. But I'll put that in the tribute if I get a chance to do that. So let's come on to your wonders. You've selected seven wonders. Mm. Was this an agony to you too, or do you have lots of wonders?
No, I never. The thing is, when anyone says, what are your favourite seven songs, your favourite seven films, I don't agonise over it because I don't think anyone's going to go, I was a little bit annoyed. In 2023, you said one of those things was one of your wonders, but then in 2025, you said something different. I don't trust you because I think it is a very impulsive thing.
Yeah.
So when I got the question, I was like, what are my wonders today? So it's going to be quite nice because some of them I might not find wonderful at all anymore.
We'll try to stick with it at least for the purpose of this recording. But Well, the thing that struck me about you, though, because you do these, how many years? Is it more than 10 years you've been doing the Infinite Monkey
Cage? Yeah, Monkey Cage's been 14 years. Yeah. We're nearly up to episode 200 now. The great thing is when you're doing a show about everything in the known universe and conjecture about the unknown universe, turns out there's a lot of stuff.
Yes.
And we very rarely get to the second question. This is the thing, when Brian and I and Sasha, our producer, meet in the afternoon, we have a rough idea of three different sections, three different areas we want to go to and whatever we're talking about. And then, of course, you ask question one, and sometimes we don't get to question one till very near the end, because someone says something in the introduction, and you want to, and that's the thing that I love, is you always, you know, we never want people to leave feeling they've just been handed a kind of half hour, here is your beginner's guide.
Yeah.
What we want people to, when they finish listening to, is go, I feel as excited as that panel, like we have this wonderful Erica McAllister. I don't know if any of you've heard that. She's a fly expert, and she has the most lurid details about flies, right? And in fact, any of you now, if you ever have a fly land in your beer, go and buy another pint. I can tell you that now, right?
Yeah.
So, and she just loves flies so much. And so suddenly people are excited by flies. And we did one about spiders, which was wonderful because it turns out Brian genuinely is scared of spiders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were out in Australia. We had an orb weaving spider. We had a huntsman spider and a St. Andrew's cross spider. And it's the first time I've seen him going, oh no, but I thought the spiders, because one came out in a little frame. He went, I thought they were all going to be in boxes.
Yeah.
I said, well, that one isn't a box. It's just that two sides of it are open. Oh. We had this wonderful, she was originally from Austria, this spider expert. And sometimes, of course, scientists take everything very, very literally, as you know. You can do a joke and then they'll go, oh, I see, Clive. Yes, that was a joke. Mm. So that wasn't meant to be Richard Dawkins, but it was. And then there was this great moment where in the sound check, he went to now you're not originally from Australia, are you? And she went, no, originally I'm from Austria, but my family had to leave after the chocolate famine. And he went, I didn't know there was a chocolate famine. And you could just see her going, I'm going to have some fun.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go on to your wonders, but just inside issue there. Now, we know Brian Cox is interested in, well, all sorts of things, but physics and science, because he studied, he's a professor, and alongside his music career as well. But you didn't do science at university,
no.
Did you? So you did sort of, is it English and drama or
I did, yeah. That was my kind of thing.
So when did you, I think a lot of people do this, because our education system, particularly in England, I don't think it's quite so much in Scotland, is very divided. And people do French, English and history, and they never go near science.
Yeah.
But then later in life, they suddenly go, hey, I've missed out on a lot of interesting... Would that apply to you?
Well, yeah, I think the problem that certainly in the English and Welsh education system is that it's far too, as you said, it's divided. Yeah. So you go, here are the arts and then this. And of course, science and English and all those things, I think the way they should be taught is with lots of overlap. You know, if you're a scientist, then it would be nice for you to study maybe Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or George Eliot's Middlemarch, all of which
and
have
to write
links
English
to,
in a way that everybody can understand, and just your colleagues across
exactly.
the laboratory.
And that storytelling, and I think lots of us, when it just gets down to the equations, we see science as something detached from the world that we're living in.
Yeah.
And so the storytelling is really required. And I know many science teachers who, you know, the trouble is that we always have the most inept and useless education secretaries, you know. Yeah. And because they're generally not passionate or curious or interested people, they actually can't when you see something like, the Prime Minister at Mickey Mouse degrees, and then the next day he's hosting the National Theatre at 10 Downing Street.
Yeah.
And you're like, these Mickey Mouse degrees, art, curiosity, science, all of these things, they need to be celebrations of the world. And they, you know, everything that I look at now becomes somehow connected also to the scientific story as well as the human story and other things.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse degree. And where is he now? Disneyland.
Yeah.
So there's... your first wonder is the Magic Roundabout.
Yeah.
Now, I can't tell exactly the age group of the audience, but there's a few shiny heads, so indicate that there'll be some people who remember the Magic Roundabout. Well, you're almost too young, really, to...
It ran throughout the 70s, and then also Nigel Planer did a new version of it on Channel 4, I think.
Yeah.
And the Magic Roundabout, if you don't know, it was written by Eric Thompson, who is the father of Emma Thompson. And Eric Thompson, so it was this a kind of animation series, stop-motion animation series, and he never actually knew what the original scripts were because it was from France.
Yes, it's an odd thing, isn't it? Because they got the footage from France, and instead of getting somebody to translate translate what they said in French. For some reason, they just gave it him, make up a story.
And they said, watch this and make up a story, right?
But nobody's ever done that before or since.
And it's the most magical thing.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you've seen the original scripts, it turns out it's nowhere near.
Yeah.
So the thing that I loved about it and the thing that I love is it never underestimated its audience of 2 to 6-year-olds, right? And his imagination, like there's a thing that's wonderful in it, that there is my introduction to the film Battleship Potemkin, right? A Russian classic, is through Eric Thompson. Because in one of the episodes, Dougal the dog is rushing around with a camera. And at one point he goes, I bet this never happened to Sergei Eisenstein. Now you would get TV executives, as you know, going, I'm sorry, Clive. No. I don't believe that our core demographic of 2 to 6-year-olds will know about the work of Sergei Eisenstein.
Mr. Tumble instead.
Mr. Tumble of the Marvel Universe, right? And as a child, it didn't matter. You didn't go, I feel alienated. I don't understand the references. You rejoiced. And then at another point in that episode alone, Dougal just suddenly goes, I am a camera. So it's like these wonderful things. Yes. And I think, you know, sometimes I go and speak at primary schools and talk to them about science, and they're the most terrifying gigs. Because, you know, I've done 14,000 seaters with Brian Cox and stuff, but it's not as scary as going to speak to year ones and year twos about science. Because you know when they're beginning to lose interest in you because the finger just keeps going further and further up the nose, you know. Yeah. And that joy of, because I was told the first time I did one, this science communicator said, you should talk about things like farting in space and you should talk about things like dinosaur poo. They love that. Yeah. And then I thought, well, these 5 and 6-year-olds, their minds have never been wider and ready to receive so many ideas. And I ended up talking about the brains inside their skulls and the number of stars inside our galaxy and the size of the universe and Jane Goodall and her work with chimpanzees. And they were just so into it.
Yeah.
And it's that thing which is, I think we now, I mean, you remember that. I can't remember if it's Hugh Carlton Green or Lord Reith, you know, when they were once asked, are you going to give the people what they want? And he went, we're going to give them something much better than that.
Yeah.
And I think far too often when art is made, people are second-guessing the audience and they're also presuming the audience are much more stupid than they are.
Yes.
You know, and that fact that we see documentaries where they keep having to do a recap and everything has to be understood. And yet for many people, if you hear a word that you don't understand, you may well be holding in your hand basically a library that will allow you to look up everything.
Yeah.
And it's never been easier to stop a show. All of those things. And I think, you know, if we keep dumbing down, then we, you know, I don't want things to be highfalutin. I want people, again, like Monkey Cage, I want everyone to feel welcome. I want everyone to feel that their curiosity is something they can share. And if they mispronounce a name, that doesn't matter. The joy is the curiosity.
All right. I think it was Lord Reith that said, I want it. BBC should give people slightly better than what they want.
Yeah.
They think they want. So, which can be regarded as a bit elitist, or it can be regarded as an aspiration to make things better rather than looking for the lowest common denominator.
Well, one of my favourite things, because I do lots of free shows in libraries and bookshops and things like that. Very often people
come
along.
How do you mean you stand up in a library and start talking? This is a free
now
show
you're
over here.
No, you shush. But when I go to those places, it's like people don't necessarily, they may not have even heard the radio show. They don't really know what to expect. And I will often go in loads of different directions. And there's a beautiful thing when someone comes up to you and says, I had no idea what to expect and I had a lovely day.
Yeah.
Or I had a man come up to me once after a show I did at Cannons Gate during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And he was about 80 years old and he was a former bricklayer and his granddaughter had brought him. And he went, I'd just like to say, I did not understand a word of that. And I've had a lovely evening. And that, you know, that kind of thing, I think, is a delight.
Still, it is a slight surprise, given that you deal with all these, well, it could be described as highfalutin topics in your performance, your radio show, that the Magic Roundabout turned out to be your number one wonder of the world. But,
hang on, you didn't tell me it was rated 1 to 7.
No, it's not rated.
Okay, I want to make that sure.
That's the first one we came to.
I used to always have a Dougal cake at my birthday. So all these pictures of me with a lovely Dougal cake with all iced, you know, fur and all that kind of stuff. It's delicious.
And he's got his hair down to the ground because they didn't want to show his feet because it made these stop.
It's great,
isn't it?
But it's such a, so my Proustian rush, for some people it's the Madeleine, and for me it's the Dougal cake. And if you got the face as well, you had a nice glacé cherry in the middle.
Oh, right, yeah. So he was your favourite character above the
Zebedee? I don't know, actually. It's really hard. I love it. I mean, there's a Mark Kermode, Dougal and the Blue Cat, is actually one of his favourite films of all time, which it really is. And
really?
Has anyone had seen Dougal and the Blue Cat? Oh, it's so good. I've really promised it. And it's got Buxton in it. Buxton's an evil blue cat. And he has a song where he goes, I'm bad, I'm bad, I'm bad, I'm bad. But most of all, I'm evil, right? And it's just, and I love all of that. Florence sings a beautiful and very, very sad song. And you do find yourself going, I'm really not meant to be crying while watching. Yeah. There you are. It's just,
all right.
Yeah, so many of them.
That's a wonderful thing. Well, I think we'll move on to the next wonder, though, which takes us
into... We've got to get through seven, haven't we?
We have, yes. Yeah. I've got a careful eye on the clock because I know everyone's got other shows to go to. Or,
there's nothing more enhancing for a guest of a show than to watch the presenter constantly looking at his watch.
Yes.
This is exactly what happened during therapy. It was the same thing.
Well, don't take it. You're clearly somebody who is able to speak at length. So, no. If it's a fault, it's definitely a fault on the right side. There's nothing worse than somebody ask you a question. I suppose so. Or, it's just the first thing I thought of. Anyway, so your next wonder that I have in the list is brain scans.
Brain scans, yeah. I was very lucky. I volunteer for lots of stuff because I meet scientists. Sometimes they're doing research and experiments, and I'll say, oh, I'd love to try that, right? So a few years ago, it was wonderful. This man, I was on a train from Tunbridge Wells after doing a gig down there, and a man came up to me and he just said, I've heard your radio show. I think you should have a brain scan. And then he said, sorry, that sounded ruder than I thought. It's not because of your appalling sentence structure. It is actually, I bet you'd be excited by having one. I said to this stranger, I said, oh, yeah, I'd really love to have a brain scan. And so I went to Imperial College. And it's just this beautiful thing. Again, this is what I spoke to the year ones and year twos about. I showed them the brain scan. And when you see this, you know, this organ, this strange, you know, it's such a kind of, you know, arcane thing to look at. It's so peculiar, so wonderful that everything or most of what is you, most of what is me, most of what is you is all inside this skull. And so I went inside this brain scanner and then it comes out with this beautiful animation that, in fact, someone from Weta out in New Zealand is making me currently a 3D model of my actual brain, which is very exciting. And I think to see your brain is just, it is quite a kind of, it's a transcendent moment to think that's where everything happens. That's where the good and the bad happens. That's also where a lot happens that I never hear. You know, that whole thing about the fascinating thing that much of what our brain is doing is totally detached from our consciousness. So again, anyone here who has anxiety or has had anxiety, you know, they'll know about the fact that sometimes you know that you're not meant to be anxious about something and you try and argue with your anxiety, but your anxiety exists in a part of the brain that doesn't understand language. So basically going, don't be so silly. Of course you don't need a wee when you're in the middle of this theatre. It's going to be fine. You can use the loo when it gets to the end of act one. You don't need a wee. Don't worry about it.
I wish you hadn't raised that as a...
Yeah. No, I know. I'm not going anywhere near that. But it is that... And you're arguing, though. You're going, don't do that. But the anxiety brain's going... Because it doesn't understand a word you're saying. Okay. So to look at all of those things... And then
can you see that in a scan, though?
You can't see very much. I mean, that's the interesting thing is it's still a very lumpen thing in terms of actually being able to see... smaller parts of behavior. We can have some sense of what activity goes on there and what activity is there, but in a very, very broad way. We really do need to be able to monitor a brain almost neuron by neuron to really start getting like the sense of the self and things like that. But I did a thing with the Christmas lectures. Sophie Scott, a friend of mine who's a neuroscientist at UCL, she asked me, because as you can see, I don't stop talking. She said, could you come on to the show and I'm going to give you a magnetic pulse to the motor region of your brain and it's going to stop you being able to talk. And it's the most fascinating. Some people find this scary.
It obviously hasn't worked, Robert.
Oh, no. If you had the equipment here, you could do it at any time whatsoever. Yeah. Brian Cox, I think, is currently doing a crowdfunding to get one.
How are you getting all these scans and devices? There's people queuing up for 18 months on the NHS.
It's if you just say, I don't know what's going to happen. Yes, just so you know, it is dangerous. Don't sign the form. Yeah. And so I sat there and I did a little bit of jab. "'Twas brillig and the slithy tove did gar and gimble in." And then this, and it just goes, "Gup." And you can see the words sometimes almost in your throat, it feels.
Wow.
And they just stop. And then once the magnetic pulse has gone, you can then start talking again.
Is that
again.
Not panic inducing?
I didn't find it was. I find it terrifying. Things like abseiling or anything like that. No bungee jumping, etc. But people mucking around with my brain for some reason, I love it.
How extraordinary. So brain scans is because you're interested in the brain, but because you can scan the whole body as well. You're not interested in that.
I find all of it interesting. I think the fact that we can see inside ourselves is a very beautiful and wonderful thing. And I think the fact that also we're beginning to understand, you know, because so often, of course, so much of our knowledge actually comes from the most terrible things. Yeah. It comes from war very often. It comes from damage that people have experienced. But the fact that now we are, like, there's an incredible scientist, and I feel annoyed that I've forgotten his name. He wrote a wonderful book. He noticed that people who appeared to be in, and I'll be very careful the way I describe this, persistent vegetative state.
Yeah.
He realized that you could find out if that person was still there, even though as yet they couldn't communicate.
Yeah.
Which is, for instance, if you play certain pieces of music, you are able to see if it's a piece of music that person is fond of, you will see a different kind of sensation in the brain. Now, if that person is no longer there, if they truly are brain dead, that won't happen. Equally, you can place a photo in front of them. You can put a series of faces. And if you put a series of faces of loved ones, whatever it might be, mothers, wives, husbands, there will be a different spike to it being a stranger. And thanks to that research, there are people who were basically left just going, they're not there anymore, who are now able to live a real semblance of a life. And that, to me, is remarkable. I should also add to that, though, because, of course, this is often hotly debated by people about sometimes when someone, you know, is having their machine turned off, you are also able to see when the architecture is just not there anymore. And when that sad thing that we as human beings, when we still see the physical form of someone, we believe we can somehow get in there. But that fact that he's been able to release people as such, I think is beautiful.
Oh, you've got to leave a list of your favourite bits of music with your loved ones so they know which one. Very awful, because if you've gone off them... I've gone off early Beatles now.
Yeah.
They're playing She Loves You. No, it's doing nothing. Go on, brain. Well, this doesn't often happen, but this now links to the next wonder, because your next wonder is Patti Smith.
Yes.
Who is a singer, a musician, but a poet, I suppose, as well. So again, there'll be plenty of people go, oh, yeah, Patti Smith, I remember her, or I know her, I love her. Other people go, oh, no, exactly, who is Patti Smith and why? So who is she and have you said, of all the, you haven't gone for Dylan, you haven't gone for...
Well, Dylan fits into this story, actually,
yes.
Because Patti Smith, I hugely recommend any of you reading her books, Just Kids, which is about when she first moved to New York, very, very young, and she lived with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe.
Yeah.
And it's the most beautiful story of two people in poverty living in just managing to survive, where, for instance, one of them, because they both loved art, and Robert Mapplethorpe always knew. He knew he was going to make it. It's a beautiful... And one of them would
make... But I think she made the money first of all. I think she...
Yeah,
but
they both became, you know, because a lot of those wonderful pictures of her were taken by Robert Mapplethorpe. And all of her books are filled with so much, even when she's dealing with tragedy and loss, there is a level of joy and passion. And when you watch her live, when you sometimes watch someone and it does feel like there's a spell on you, this is not just someone doing a show. This is, in fact, I went to see Bruce Springsteen. I went to see Bruce Springsteen on his most recent tour. Yeah, right. That, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, right? Because you were, and of course he sang the song that he co-wrote with Patti Smith, Because the Night.
Yeah.
And it was just 3 hours of these musicians, many of whom are in their 70s now. They just came out there. Springsteen goes, 1, 2, and off they go into a song. The song stops, 1, 2, the next song. Yeah. An hour and a half of that, and then another hour and a half, and a little story in between, and the passion of that. And you don't just feel this is not just a commercial transaction. This is someone who says, you're here, and I'm going to give you a very, very special night. And Patti Smith is like that. Now, when you mentioned Bob Dylan, Patti Smith actually went and received his Nobel Prize for Literature, because Dylan didn't travel to it.
Yeah.
And one of the many reasons that I love Patti Smith, so there's a beautiful moment, and it's on YouTube if you want to see this, where there's all of those people, you know, the Nobel, there's just hundreds of people, thousands of people, black ties, very, very ornate, huge amount of pressure. And then there's an orchestra and she starts singing a Dylan song. And she gets to the second verse and she gets a line wrong and she stops. And the guitarist stops. And then they start again and she gets the line wrong a second time. And then there's just silence and she goes, I'm sorry, I'm very nervous. And it's the most beautiful moment because as she does that, that moment of what some would see as failure just increased the humanity.
Yeah.
And the fact that someone who's been an artist for as long as she had could also just stop and say, I need to tell you this.
Yes.
And you look at the people's faces. Yeah. You can see some people kind of going, well, I'm very unimpressed. But what you predominantly see is people going, what a beautiful moment.
Yeah. So So, I didn't bring up Dylan because of that. But you know, you mentioned Because of the Night with Bruce Springsteen, and then Gloria, which is a Van Morrison or probably them. But so she adapted that song or rewrote that song.
Oh, it's a huge song. Yeah, it's just kind of. But she is, when you watch her live, and when she does an incredible cover version of Midnight Oil's Beds Are Burning, which is like about 12 minutes long and becomes this epic poem. And she is someone that you just look at her. There are certain, I mean, in another way, someone like Dick Van Dyke has a similar gift to me. It's like I didn't really particularly like the Mary Poppins film that came out recently, but the moment Dick Van Dyke came on, it's suddenly there are certain people. It's like one of my favourite things, I'd have included this in the Seven Wonders of the World, I don't think I did, is any footage of Dick Van Dyke surprising diners inside a restaurant by suddenly singing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's like Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Bang Bang, and then everyone joins in and people are going, that's Dick Van Dyke, that is Dick Van Dyke. It's that level of joy, and it's that thing to me which as an artist and as a performer, you should never be on just kind of auto. You should always be in the room. It's one of the reasons that I love Rick Mayall, was every time you watch Rick Mayall, you never felt he was shortchanging an audience.
Yeah,
you
know? Dick Van Dyke was always unfortunate. People say, oh, and you did that ludicrous Cockney accent. He sort of apologised. He said, no, don't apologise. It was great. It was great getting the accent a bit weird. It marked the film. You know, Mary Poppins was made by that. Okay, so Patti Smith, you've obviously seen her perform.
Yeah.
I mean, long time ago.
I saw her when she was on a bill with Nick Cave in Victoria Park, and there was Courtney Barnett was on, and Brick Smith from The Fall, and the Psychedelic Furs, and it was. But she, I was chatting to a mate of mine that I was with there, and we both said, even though Nick Cave was the person on last and the person at the top of the, and I love Nick Cave, but for us, it was Patti Smith that time.
She's the wonder of the world. Yeah. So you haven't gone with Joni Mitchell or Janis Joplin or, you know, Kate Bush.
There's so many people that I could have gone with. But I do feel that Patti Smith, for me, also it's interesting you mentioned Joni Mitchell, because I know that she did no one knew she was going to come on. There were people doing a kind of tribute thing, and then they said, but who sings Joni Mitchell songs better than anyone else? Joni Mitchell. The audience didn't know. She came on. Imagine
that
excitement.
She's been very unwell.
She's been very, very unwell. And I then heard that someone went, oh, she didn't sing the songs very well. And I hate it when it's like Kris Kristofferson. I remember some people after, and I've seen him live, right? Yeah. People after he did Glastonbury, they went, oh, I didn't think he did the songs very well. Yeah. You go, you're watching Kris Kristofferson. There is a point when you're watching someone on stage where it doesn't matter that I don't want them to sing the way they did when they were 30. No. It's like when you listen to Johnny Cash, you listen to those later recordings of Johnny Cash, you hear his age. Yeah. You hear the gravel. Yeah, anyone who goes, oh, they missed that note. Well, they sound like the most joyless, and I won't say the second word because it would get bleeped out.
Yeah,
but
okay.
I
don't know. Even Elton John.
It would have been prick.
Elton John at...
Sorry.
Elton John at Glastonbury, people said that as well.
His voice it's like that. Well, it's not just
he's
about...
He's 93 or whatever it is. And he's still going strong. Well done. He could be president as well.
But that's one of the things I love as well. I'm going to throw in another one. Mavis Staples. I don't know if any of you know the Staples singers. Mavis Staples, who did her dad, Pop Staples, wrote a song called Freedom Highway. Yeah. It's the most brilliant song, covered by the Specials on their last album. And she, when I last saw her, I welled up when she did Freedom Highway. It's the most beautiful song about civil rights as well. And I chatted to someone who'd been at the venue she played the night before, and they went, this little old woman turned up. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, how is she going to go on stage? And she was just there, and then she went on stage and she was the most alive of anyone, whatever age they could have been.
And you mentioned Sinead O'Connor as well. I introduced her because I mentioned this on the radio a couple of weeks ago before this recording, because I interviewed her on Loose Ends, and she was gonna sing a song, and then the course of the interview I said I liked another song from the album, so she said, oh, I'll sing that instead. So she said, and there was this consternation amongst the people in charge because it was a potentially libelous song, and she had to sing it a cappella, but that's why she wanted to sing it, because she wasn't sure about the tuning of her guitar. And it was just such a, and it was, she was a really interesting person.
She was a brilliant human being. She was
so honest. Every time she went into a different line of thing, it wasn't, and I can think of other singers who affect a bit of sort of outrage, and but her outrage is always from the heart.
I think she's a great lesson to all of us, which is don't wait till someone's died to become their ally. You know, there's that beautiful line that she quoted from, I forget the name of the Greek poet now, from the 1970s, which is, they buried me, but they didn't know I was a seed. And I think that is...
Oh, yeah.
Can I just say, when mentioning musicians, one of my favourite times ever on Loose Ends, do you remember when Ginger Baker was on?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God, right. So Clive had to interview Ginger Baker. I can't believe I'd forgotten about that until you mentioned that, right? You know, Ginger Baker, the drummer. Yeah. And I would say it's fair to say that... he's a problematic interviewer, isn't he? Right. So Clive had obviously read the whole of Ginger Baker's book. Ginger Baker's daughter had turned up to apologise for him after the show, which is obviously one of her jobs she had to do.
Yeah.
And Clive was just there asking all of these wonderful, intricate questions taken from the book, and he would just go, no. Did I? And I eventually could hear the producer saying, give up now, Clive. Because it was about 20 minutes of just, And then I was interviewing the physicist, Marcus Chown. I don't know if you remember this, right?
Yeah.
And I said, I'm joined by the physicist, Marcus Chown, and we're going to talk about some of the ideas of the universe. And out of nowhere, this man who had been monosyllabic throughout suddenly went, are you a big banger? Are you a big banger? Do you believe in a big bang? Big Bang's a load of rubbish, mate. And I could just see Clive going, if only I've been told to interview him about cosmology. Yeah. That's the one place that he's... That was an amazing day.
Well, it wasn't amazing. But oddly enough, I mentioned the Sinead O'Connor, but he came on that as well. He came on. So I was interviewing... I mean, I just this as a badge of honour. I was interviewing Sinead O'Connor, who could sometimes be a difficult interviewee, but she wasn't on this occasion. And then I was going on to Ginger Baker. So I was able to say to him, it might have even been your joke, but it was an esprit d'escalier which went right, because I said, oh, last time you were on, you said you didn't believe in the Big Bang Theory, and you're a drummer, you must believe in Big Bang. But I remember we chatted about it, it was like 3 years later. He was an interesting guy. He was on to talk about a documentary which somebody had made, and in the documentary he hits the documentary maker. You know, yeah. So I don't know if everyone does. So and draws blood.
Yeah.
And it's only because the guy says, oh, he'd spent 3 days with him in his place in Africa. And they said, oh, I'm now going to go and talk to your, I don't know, your ex-wife, your girlfriend. No, you're not. He started hitting him.
Yeah.
So he never did that to me. I'm obviously losing my edge.
Clive, where would you like Ginger to sit? Oh, with the other end, I think. There we go.
Could he take his walking stick?
Yeah.
No weapons.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Libraries is your next one. So I'm a perfectly understandable one of a man of your erudition and interest. So are you talking about public libraries that...
Public libraries in particular, all libraries, but public libraries. I think Carl Sagan, the great science communicator, he said, libraries are a mark of civilization, you know? And I think that thing, which is to have people have the freedom to take out any book that they want, to sit in the library. You know, I've done some various bits of library campaigning, and people will often go, oh, libraries, they're just kind of for the middle class, aren't they? And that's normally said by somebody who's middle class and doesn't have a library membership card. And the point is, when I go to libraries, I just find they are full of so many different people. You know, there's a beautiful library in Preston called the Harris, and you walk in there and you find there are children there having stories read to them. There are elderly people there able to read some of the magazines and newspapers they might not be able to afford at home and go through the books as well. There are very often refugee groups there because they can't afford to go to a cafe, but they can have meetings there. The librarians do such incredible work. There's things in the storerooms. There are so... And it's that access to ideas. I can see why, you know, that lots of the libraries that I've been to recently are always fighting for funds. And I love librarians as well. I love... My friend Richard Boone, who was also the... he used to be the manager of the Buzzcocks in the 1970s. He also worked at Rough Trade Records when the Smiths were signed, and he appears in Morrissey's autobiography in the one line, "And then Richard Boone said something very unhelpful." Yeah, and and also he then became a librarian. Mm. And he took me into the stacks, which is kind of the back area of the library, and he was just showing me all the stuff in the back. And there was this beautiful moment where he showed me the large print Mills and Boone, and they said, over there are all the audiobooks, and all of those audiobooks are for the people who can't get into the library anymore. And some of them are people who were library regulars and they're losing their sight, but they still want to be involved in books. He said, that one was the most fun book. He said, when we lent that one out. And he said, there's a woman called Margaret, and she rings us up every Tuesday for a book to listen to. And one Tuesday she rang up and she went, "Richard, I've decided what I'd like this week. I've had a look at the list, and I would like to listen to 50 Shades of Grey, please." Yeah. And Richard went, "Oh, are you sure, Margaret?" She went, yes, I'm sure." He goes, "You do know it's racy?" She went, "Of course I know it's racy, Richard. I've lived a life. I lived through the war." Yeah, they sent it round. And on the Friday at 9 a.m, the phone rang and it was Margaret. And she went, "Richard, CD3 is filthy." And he said, "I did warn you." She went, "No, it's filthy. It's got marmalade on it or something. It won't play."
Yeah.
And I got to a great bit of sadomasochism, you know. And I just... So I those... When I meet people in libraries, and like I said, I quite often do free gigs in libraries, I just love the people that I meet. And it's that passion for ideas. You know, Neil Gaiman said, libraries are one of the last buildings where you walk into it and no one's there waiting to take money off you.
Yes. You know? Well, sometimes if you're late back with your books, that's the...
Well, that's your problem, I'm afraid, Clive. Well, that's not the libraries.
Obviously, like a lot of things provided by local authorities, usually it's under pressure because their budgets... are not large. And I suppose the trouble with libraries is for a lot of people, it's not as necessary as they used to be, because a reference library used to be a place everybody would have to go to look things up. And now, as you sort of mentioned in passing earlier on, you've got your phone in your hand or a computer at home, or you can look up...
A lot of people still haven't.
No, I know. I'm not saying these aren't good things, but they...
Stop closing the libraries, Clive. I'm going to take you down, man. Yeah.
So do you think there should be one of these sort of multi-billionaire people? You know, Carnegie, who came from, I think, Dunfermline, you know, in Scotland, and then went to America. And then he made a lot of money out of, I think it was steel. But he gave loads and loads of money all around the world, but in America and Scotland.
Well,
Britain,
I think...
To start libraries. Yeah. So there's all those... You know, the Musks and the Bransons and all the other ones.
Yeah, stop trying to send people into space with your ridiculous Freudian rocket ships.
Yeah.
And I really do, even though I love science, and I know we're probably going to get to SpaceX, but I keep making links for you, don't I?
Thank you.
Great, yeah. But I really think
you're spending
that
so long doing the links and not going to get to the seventh one.
But it is, I think what we need to do is spend more time making sure that people on Earth who are here now on a terraformed world, as it is, and we need to give people libraries. I mean, it's ridiculous. The things that have to fund themselves, hospices. Yeah. 80. My niece is a pediatric nurse. She cycled around 84 children's hospices in the UK last year to make funds for them. Right, these kind of things. I'm getting onto it, but I think there are so many things that will make lives of human beings, all human beings, not just 2% of the human beings, better. Yeah. And part of that is libraries and knowledge. And when we empower ourselves with knowledge, and that's why people don't like libraries, because you leave it armed.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that's...
there's my bit for you.
Yeah.
But I really do feel...
But there are, we're putting on to, you know, billionaires, and, you know, Bill Gates has done a lot of charitable work in very worthwhile things, but we need another Carnegie to perhaps not even open libraries, but just keep them open, the ones that are there. Anyway, okay, well, I think that speaks for itself. But now you go on to something which is pretty scientific, CERN.
Yeah,
which I presume you've gone to visit this.
Yeah.
So tell us about what CERN is. And
CERN is this wonderful place of physics, basically. One of the reasons that it was built was, of course, after the Second World War, physics was seen as being, as you'll see if you go and see Oppenheimer, it was seen as being the atom bomb. Mm. Physics had started to be seen as a very, very negative thing. It was something that had given people incredible, you know, very, very dangerous powers. So CERN, one of the reasons it was built was two reasons. One was to show this incredible positive side of physics, and also the international side of physics. So it was a place where physicists from all around the world would go and work and be united in kind of almost this country, this small country of physics, right? And what I find so wonderful about it is I was there back in January. I said in some ways it's almost like Stonehenge, because maybe in 5,000 years' time, people will find what lies underneath this bit of Switzerland.
So how big is it? It's a big circular thing,
isn't it? It's about 29 kilometres of the Large Hadron Collider around. And it's just this incredible thing, which is here is this thing which is sending around bundles of subatomic particles at speeds near that of light. Yeah. And they're colliding, and we're finding out why matter is matter and why the universe is as it is. And it's that beautiful thing as well, which science, to me, if we always talk about answers, it's not about answers, it's about growing new questions. So when Peter Higgs, and some of you might have seen that footage, because Peter, based in the university up here, you know, Peter Higgs, he as a young man had come up with an idea, and then there's this incredible thing that is built to test his idea. And after all of those years, an old man sits in a room not dissimilar to this and sees that his idea of the Higgs fold and the Higgs field and the Higgs boson was a good idea. And when you go down into, I mean, it's an amazing, have you been there?
I haven't. My wife's been there, oddly enough, and she's a bit claustrophobic, so she's visited lots of it, but she didn't go right into the depths.
Oh, because you go 100 metres underground.
Somebody said that to her, and that was the point. That was the point she decided
well, of course,
to go
you,
to the
you
canteen.
Well, of course, you can lie with a lift, can't you? It's just a five metre lift, you know. But and you go down, and then you turn this corner, and there you see part of this, just this magnificence, this beauty, all of that human ingenuity. And I just find that way of testing why the universe is as it is so beautiful. And I remember when we were driving back and forth, I was making I made a kind of 45-minute documentary that was mixing the show I was doing for the people at CERN that night, and then me just meeting different people. And I just kind of, every time that we went for a little drive, I thought of all the different layers. Again, I'm fascinated by the idea of the block universe, this idea that there are layers of time, and that, you know, when you walk around Edinburgh and you think about the history of Edinburgh, sometimes you almost see ghosts, you know, you think, because it's a place of so many stories.
Yeah.
And that's what I saw when I was looking at CERN, is I was looking at all the different stories on every different level, from the electrical pylons to the farms, and thinking about what was going on the farms, to think about, as I went past Woodland, all of the mycorrhizal connections that are underneath the trees and this kind of communication that appears to go on, which seemed like such an absurd idea initially, but it's now testable. And then you get down to that area of subatomic particles, but, you know, clashing together. And it's that beauty of all of the stories, some human stories, some stories of nature.
I know you're going to say, oh, we're just going to ask another question, but is it going to tell us about the Big Bang, or how these particles?
Well, the Big Bang is the Big Bang's a different question, really, because the Big Bang, the problem we have there is scientists have only managed to get back to the first 10 to the minus 37 of a second, which is just an incredibly tiny amount of time, right? That is so remarkable to me. And you then get to this point where quantum behavior and relativity and the nature of gravity just don't seem to be able to link. Yeah. And that's their problem. And a scientist said to me, in the end, we'll have to disprove gravity. Now, that was beautiful, because I then told an audience that night, and 10 people got really scared. Yeah. And I said, no, whatever keeps us on the ground, we'll still keep working. It won't be going, they've disproved gravity. Yeah. You fools! Right? But that,
and what came before the Big Bang?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is if we can get to that first point. Yeah. But I mean, how incredible to get to that incredible, you know, that tiny, tiny fracture of time. Yeah. So that's,
well, there wasn't anything before then, because time.
Yeah, well, that's again,
or God created. I know that's not your theory, because we're fair to say, it's a very militant atheist.
Oh, not militant, no, because I don't care if people... I think I'd be militant if I wanted to tell everyone not to believe in God. A lot of my friends, you know, I don't want to name drop Clive, but if you don't mind, I am friends with the Bishop of Leeds. So, but I think there are lots of people... I think one of the problems with Richard Dawkins and others from the atheist movement is they haven't realised that for many people, God and faith is not held in the same part of the brain as lots of kind of what you might call evidence-based ideas. It's held in a place of emotion. It's held in a place of connection. I don't care what anyone believes in. I only care about whether their belief then allows them to punish other people and be cruel to other people and becomes an alibi for their bigotry. And nearly all the religious people I know, and certainly all the religious people I hang around with, that it's like we did an episode of Monkey Cage where we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on, and we also had the Dean of Guildford Cathedral, right? Wonderful. wonderful man, Victor Stock, who has this wonderful rather camp way about him, right? He turns up the camp a little bit when he's trying to disconcert people who are having a go. He goes, oh, yes, well, of course, yes, well, that's the many forms of God, isn't it? And he's got this great way, kind of rather Kenneth Williams, right? We had, on this particular show, we had the scientists, and then we had a thing called Clerical Corner, which was we would throw to the religious people for their take on that, right? And Neil deGrasse Tyson, the first time that he'd finished explaining some scientific idea, and Brian went, and now we're going to go over to Clerical Corner. And Neil deGrasse Tyson went, Clerical Corner? Is there a physics corner in all of their churches? And Victor went, well, of course, in Westminster Abbey, one of the things we've got is in one corner, we've got Isaac Newton and also Charles Darwin, and of course, now Stephen Hawking. And one of the things we try and do, and I could just see Neil deGrasse Tyson going, I can battle against extremists, but kindly, incredibly well-read, passionate and curious members of the General Synod, they are my kryptonite. And it was that beautiful moment. This argument is not required.
Okay.
This idea. So yeah, I would say I'm not militant. I'm pretty relaxed about, I'm just not keen on in cruelty towards people.
Okay, all right. Well,
and some atheists are right. Anyway, so there we go.
We're running out of time.
No, we're not. I checked with Brian. No, it turns out time's an illusion. We can keep going for as long as you want.
Time's an illusion. I was like the idea that time's an illusion. That means you don't turn up for a certain arrangement.
Yeah. Time's an illusion, tea time doubly so.
Yes. Okay, your sixth wonder, which we just about have enough time.
We're going to get both. I'll do them really quick.
We're going to do all the time. So this is the Earthrise photograph.
The Earthrise photograph taken by Apollo 8, I think, is a beautiful thing for us to be able to look back on our own planet. I think it's a very, very important again, in politics and all those things, is that idea that if to see the fragility, to see the beauty, to see, like, friends with... Oh, are we finished?
No.
Oh, I thought you were right.
I was describing with my hand the photograph.
Oh, okay.
So you see the Earth as though it is it's from the moon, so it's now looking like the moon or a very it's a lonely planet.
And it happened by mistake as well. That's the beautiful thing. Taking an image of the Earth was not the plan
with a camera.
Well, we've all done that.
You take a figure of your thumb or something.
The crew of Apollo 8 were a bit disappointed in the moon and thought it was a bit boring. They were kind of just looking at the moon and observing where the landing point might be for Apollo 11. And so they were a bit bored. And then they looked out the window and went, oh my goodness, we live there.
Yeah.
And that's when Jim Lovell said, get the camera. Let's get a shot of the Earth. And I'll tell you a little story about...
So were NASA a bit annoyed? They said, you've been sent up to get photographs of the moon. You've sent the photographs of the Earth.
Yeah,
we can get much better photographs of the Earth back here.
Well,
we're on the Earth.
Some of the greatest astronomical photographs, like Carl Sagan's image that was taken by Voyager, you know, became known as the pale blue dot, which again, this beautiful image of the Earth where it's just a tiny dot in a shaft of light. Mm. That he had to argue with for ages to say, this gives us a sense of our place, even just in the solar system. But this is, I want to tell you about Chris Hadfield, who's a wonderful astronaut and someone that I love working with and talking to.
Is he the one that played guitar and stuff?
Yeah, he played guitar in space. He's got a band. He's written some wonderful books. I just want to tell you a lovely story. I mentioned that my niece was a pediatric nurse, and there was a young boy, Henry, who was the most wonderful. He was an eight-year-old who just loved space and stuff like that. Unfortunately, he then got leukemia and he's very, very ill. And what I want to say about Chris and nearly all the astronauts that I feel so lucky to have met, lots of astronauts, is the generosity and kindness and what they've got from going into space and the way they reach out to people. And this little lad, he really loved Chris's picture book, All About the Nature of Dark. And I said, Chris, look, I'm really sorry to ask this, but there's a young lad, his name's Henry, and he's not very well, and I wondered if you could record a message for him. He said, why don't I do a Zoom meeting with him? So he took half an hour of his time, or more than that, to talk to an eight-year-old about space. And when Henry then got very ill, then it was kind of, we knew it was going to be the last weekend of his life. I got in contact with Chris. I said, sorry to ask again, but Henry's really ill. And could you send a message? And he said, yes. And he sent back the most beautiful message. He filmed himself. He said, hello, Henry. I just was remembering a time I was on the International Space Station and I was looking out the window, which is, of course, what I did every time I had a free moment. And I suddenly saw a shooting star travel between the ISS and the planet Earth. And I'd never seen anything like that before. And you know what? I'm wishing on that star so hard for you today. And I think those kind of stories, again, like when we were talking about science education, education. Yeah. Those stories, which are stories of an enormous wonder, and they're also stories that reach out and make a human connection. And I just wanted to mention him because he's someone that I, you know, that bit where you just wanted to, you know, when you know someone is really great and you want everyone else to know it too.
Well, that's a very good story. And I think it's a wonderful story to end that wonder. So I won't ask you to expand any more on the Earthrise photograph. And so we come to your final wonder, which is a group of standing stones.
Yeah. So, stones of Callanish. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Does anyone want to correct me? Because I never know if it's Niche or Nish. I think it's Stones of Callanish on the Isle of Lewis. Yeah. In, which one do you reckon? Niche. You reckon Niche. Okay. So
Callanish.
Okay. It's the start of a song there, isn't it? Niche. Yeah. You say Niche and I say Niche. But Stones of Callanish, the penultimate gig I did before lockdown, I went to Isle of Lewis and I was there on the only sunny day in the whole of February, right? Yeah. Poured down for the first 25 days, storms for the last 2 days, 26th of February, beautiful sunlight. And I was given a lift to Stones of Callanish and I just had it all to myself. And I wandered around and I stood there and I had that moment where there's a stone that's known as the hand stone because it's shaped a bit like a stand. The Gnesian rock there is where all the kind of crystals in it and stuff, as the sun changes, it's almost like the shape of the rocks changes. Well, it's very, very beautiful. And I just ended up placing my hand on the hand stone and I had this tremendous rush of different images. I had that moment of thinking of everyone who had stood where I had stood. You know, some of them in sandals, some of them barefoot, some of them in Wellington boots, some of them in cagoules, some of them with rabbit fur, you know, different gods in the sky. Maybe only one God in the sky, maybe no God in the sky, and all of those things. And I had that wonderful sensation that comes in certain places, and it doesn't even have to be somewhere as magical as that. And it was just such a beautiful experience to have.
Yeah.
And then after that, it kind of reminded me of, you know, I'm often on the quest for that kind of transcendent moment. And I think the more that you tune yourself into it, you can find, like, another wonder I could have said was the wall of Darlington Station at Platform 2.
A very similar structure.
It's just this great big... You get to look at it for a long time because our infrastructure is appalling and the train's going to be late, you know. And I remember after the Stones of Callanish, I was standing there and I suddenly thought about all the hands that had been all of those bricks and all the minds that gone into it. And again, it's that bit of when we open ourselves up to stories, and when we do that, everywhere becomes just, it's got a kind of, it's viscous. The air is viscous around these places.
Well, oddly enough, somebody else, many episodes ago, this... selected the Stones of Callanish. So I told the story then because I have a friend who is the most sensible. He works in television. He comes from a good Scots background, but he can't go. He's been there and he can't stay there because there's a sort of electric charge that he gets off those stones, which is almost unbelievable. But that, you know, he's a very reliable witness about that. So there's something in those stones, or the history, or the something. People, I think, get less of that feeling of Stonehenge, because Stonehenge has been sort of mucked around too much, and the stones have fallen down, been put up again. There's a sort of purity to the stones there, and the site is so evocative, isn't it?
But well, I think what you're saying there as well is that we bring so much with us. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like when we did a show on Monkey Cage about if you don't know the difference between if you can't see whether it's white wine or red wine, it's almost impossible to tell which is white and which is red. And you won't believe that now. Brian is a keen wine enthusiast, and he failed on that test, as did I. And you suddenly go, yes, when we see a glass of white wine, we're not doing it consciously, but actually our experience of the world brings that taste, is part of the thing. And that's the thing, again, goes yet again back to it. Brian was furious. He went, no, the reason I said white wine was because, no, because it was such a lovely thing. He got so up in arms. And I said, next week we're doing a show about the male ego. So it's, you know, kind of...
Another good game you can play, I've done this on making documentaries with people late at night. You get five examples of whiskey. And you have, a nice sort of peaty one and a Glenmorangie one and maybe a bourbon, to mix it in, and a brandy. You do a blind tasting and you can't tell the difference.
That's brilliant.
You can't tell even which is the brandy. But I think something to do with you shouldn't drink too much of each whiskey as it goes along. But there's no way you can tell the difference.
That's Clive's alibi for having the most parlous whiskey cabinet. Is that all you've got? Teachers, put the blindfold on. I'll tell you it's something else.
Well, you just pour it into the... Oh, no, I wouldn't drink it.
I don't know if that's your excuse, actually, for poor quality whiskey. Poor quality. Or for putting blindfolds on people, actually, now I think about it. Well, now there's the revelation of the podcast.
Who needs an excuse for that? Anyway, look, thank you very much for your seven wonders. My job, I have to select the wonder of wonder, the wonder that you have gone into, which was most impressive. And I was you know, very impressed with your erudition about CERN and the Earthrise photograph is very, and those stones of Kalanish again. But I think for just the shock of the or the surprise of having it, I think having the magic roundabout forever associated with your name as the wonder of the world. So I will nominate that as your wonder of wonders. So thank you very much for joining
thank
us today.
Thank you very much, Clive.
Robin Hintz, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.